Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Today on the show, we go back through history of World War II when imprisoned Japanese Americans performed music for Wyomingites.
This band was also kind of goodwill ambassadors, sort of reintroducing or introducing for the first time Japanese American faces to some of these places.
A Sheridan conservation group is proposing an expansion of a local trail system.
It's not always easy to get up to the top of Red Grade, and this winds up being able to provide more recreational opportunities.
150 years ago, a group of explorers set out to fill in the blank spaces on the map along the Green and Colorado rivers. This year, a team of scientists retraced their steps.
You would have to use a lot of exclamation points for what we've seen and experienced on this trip.
We'll have those stories and more coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. The recently bankrupt coal company Black Jewel may soon be selling its mines to Contura Energy, a previous owner. Court filings say it hopes to keep the Bel Air and Eagle Butte mines open for 6 to 12 years. But anonymous sources tell Wyoming Public Radio that may be significantly shorter. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim joins us to talk about the story that was reported by him and Catherine Wheeler. So what have you learned about Contura's new timeline?
So Contura was just approved as the successful purchaser this week, pending some tax issues with the federal government. The public has been told the company plans to restart operations at the two mines for 6 to 12 years. That's been a big draw to choosing Contura from the court's perspective. I've been listening over the phone daily. The judge and Black Jewel's attorney seem to agree it's the best option for the company, both to maximize value and bring employees back to work. But a source who's chosen to remain anonymous, but who's also close to the negotiation, says Contura may actually only keep mines open for 6 to 12 months.
So tell us a little bit more about that. What's going on?
So from court, I know Contura said it wants to bring back about 500 people. Those employees would get back the money owed to them in pre-petition or pre-bankruptcy wages. On July 1st, when the company originally filed for bankruptcy, it furloughed all of its employees, about 600, only to bring back a small skeleton crew to keep everything safe. And as far as next steps go that were not in court, one source tells us Contura may plan to mine the coal that's already exposed, sell it, and then move on to the reclamation process. That's much faster than what we expected. Unless that liability is sold off to someone else, Contura could keep on a small portion of its staff to handle all that.
Why would Contura be interested in buying Black Jewel if they don't want to run it?
So Contura used to be the owners of both Eagle Butte and Bel Air, but basically gave them away at the end of 2017. It gave Black Jewel the mines, and in exchange, Black Jewel would take over all $250 million in reclamation costs. Contura even paid them about $21 million to help seal the deal. Since then, though, that mine permit transfer never went through, so Contura is still on the hook for all that money, hundreds of millions of dollars. So rather than having to pay all that off, Contura has decided to put up a bid and just keep going.
Now, I know Contura's sale isn't quite settled with the West Virginia court, too. There's still an issue with the federal government money issue. Is that right?
Right. So there are a lot of back taxes and unpaid royalties that Black Jewel and Contura owe to the Interior Department before the government will sign off on the deal, over $50 million. And that's held up the closing of the Contura deal. It's still not settled. Contura's attorney mentioned during court earlier this week it would use royalties and new revenue to pay them back once things get going. But an early closing, as this source tells us, would hamper that plan. Black Jewel's attorney has outright said the federal government is what's holding up this deal.
Now, what can the public expect to come next with this Contura deal?
As of Tuesday, Contura said it would pay over $33 million for both Wyoming mines and another complex in West Virginia. They said this deal would bring back around 500 employees. Beyond that, the court is still waiting to see a resolution with the federal government and a final plan. There's also about $37 million owed to Campbell County in unpaid taxes. There's likely a deal there, though that's not public yet either.
Cooper, thank you so much for joining us. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim, assisted in reporting the story by Catherine Wheeler. You can find Cooper's past stories on this topic at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Turning now to Washington, the Trump administration is trying to relocate the bulk of the headquarters of the Bureau of Land Management from Washington to Colorado, which is getting cheers from Wyoming lawmakers. But as correspondent Matt Laszlo reports from Washington, Democrats view the move as problematic and a way to gut the agency.
For years, Wyoming lawmakers have complained that government employees in their press shirts and suits are making decisions that impact the lives of their constituents. So they're welcoming the Trump administration's plan to only leave about 60 Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, employees here in D.C., out of the 550 currently located here. Here's Wyoming Senator John Barrasso.
And I think it's just a good idea to get people out of Washington, away from the Beltway, and closer to home, and where the decisions, I think, are more are made much more on a reasonable basis. But, you know, you don't want unelected, unaccountable, heavy-handed bureaucrats making decisions that impact our lives, and often when they don't know anything about us.
But currently, only about 6% of BLM employees are located in Washington, which is why the Trump administration's effort is viewed skeptically by many Democrats.
Just an effort to undermine the way the BLM functions.
That's New Mexico Democratic Senator Tom Udall. He says the BLM staff currently in Washington play a vital role in assisting federal law and rulemaking.
You know, frequently we have a lot of questions as to, from members of Congress, what BLM is doing and where they're headed. And if you don't have the top people in Washington, you can't answer the questions. We've seen that in the past.
Udall says with around 95% of the BLM's workforce currently in the field, this move is unnecessary. But Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney says Udall and other Western Democrats who are voicing these complaints have spent too much time in Washington themselves.
I think that that's probably a fear that you hear from Eastern Democrats who, you know, don't understand how the real America lives.
New Mexico Democratic Senator Martin Heinrich is open to moving BLM out west. Still, Heinrich says the announcement comes at an odd time, right before an election year where Republican Colorado Senator Cory Gardner is up for re-election in one of the hottest races this cycle. So he fears it's
an effort to either help an individual senator in their reelect, or more importantly, to push career professionals who really know how to do their job out, then that would be deeply troubling.
But Cheney counters that government employees who work on Western issues should be longing to move out west.
Frankly, I think once they've had the chance to be out and visit Wyoming and Colorado and see what life is really like out there, we call it God's country. We anticipate that we'll have a lot of folks who are clamoring to get out there.
Wyoming Senior Senator Mike Enzi supports the move for a typical reason. It could actually save the government money. Enzi chairs the Budget Committee and notes that the administration estimates the relocation will save more than $50 million.
There's something to be said for having the workers where the work is, instead of paying for all the travel back and forth. I suspect they're also looking at it as a way to clean out some of the deadwood. You know, when a president moves somebody that had an appointed office down below that at-will position, you can't ever get rid of them.
Enzi also thinks the move could help cut the duplicative federal programs that now have overlapping jurisdiction on Western issues.
Well, my problem in the federal government is we don't even know what programs we're paying for, let alone how much they are, let alone whether they're authorized or not, let alone how much duplication there are. That's what I'm trying to get at with budget reforms, is forcing us to take a look at what we're doing and seeing if the money is actually making it to the program, not just paying for a bunch of bureaucrats to run a program.
The Trump administration is hoping to complete the move by the end of 2020. But Democrats are promising to try to stop it when lawmakers have to come together and fund the agency this fall. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
When we come back, we will have a conversation about how those on the Wind River Reservation can advocate for students, and the Mountain West has extremely high numbers for suicide. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. According to a recent Gallup poll, the Mountain West is home to some of the happiest states in the country. Paradoxically, we also have some of the highest rates of depressive disorders and suicide. Researchers are trying to find out why. Turns out the mountains might have something to do with it. Ray Ellen Bichel starts us off with a story about an odd experiment.
Back in 1991, a crew of eight people stepped into a series of sealed glass rooms in Arizona. They didn't come out for 2 years and 20 minutes. One of them was Mark Nelson.
It was a pretty radical experiment.
It was called Biosphere 2, and it was a privately funded experiment to recreate a mini version of our ecosystem.
I think all of the crew, we fell in love with our world. Everything made sense in Biosphere 2.
Except there was a problem. As the months went by, the oxygen level dropped. A lot of it ended up stuck in the building's concrete. It got down to about 14%, which is about the oxygen availability you'd expect on top of a 13,000-foot mountain.
I think I didn't realize it because, we kind of were like the lobsters in the pot.
But eventually they started feeling pretty bad. They were low energy, several developed sleep apnea, three started talking to therapists on the phone. Everyone ended up getting psych evaluations.
We were tested not to be depressed. But, subjectively, you can feel depressed.
Finally, Mission Control injected a bunch of oxygen into the building.
Yeah, it was wild. Suddenly I found myself running and laughing and party time.
There are a lot of obvious reasons that Nelson and his crew members' experience is not at all representative of the real world, from their specialized diet to the fact that this was a group of people that basically said, sure, we'll live in a box for 2 years. But in terms of oxygen having real effects on their bodies, they might be a good example of something researchers think is happening across our region.
I think that's a totally appropriate example.
Brent Caius is a psychiatrist with the University of Utah. He's among a group of researchers who think that the lack of oxygen at altitude could actually be messing with people's mental health, and that it might help explain higher rates of suicide and depression in mountainous areas. Basically, the brain needs oxygen in order to function, and it needs more oxygen to do things like communicate between the parts of the brain that handle reasoning and emotion.
They're very close, very complicated connections between those parts, and we know from a lot of other studies that they're disrupted in many people with depression. So hypoxia might contribute to that in a couple of ways.
Like by withholding energy from the reasoning part of our brains, which could impact the ability to regulate emotions. Or maybe it messes with serotonin production, also important for mood. None of this is certain.
No, I think it would be fair to say that it is still a fairly controversial hypothesis among people who are aware of it.
And a lot of people aren't even aware of it. But a growing number of studies back up the idea, like one in Peru on electrical workers. The one stationed at about 10,000 feet had more symptoms of depression and anxiety than their sea-level colleagues. Or the study on a small group of Marines before, during, and after a month of altitude training. They showed more symptoms of depression. So did medical students who moved higher up for residency. And then there's a study in rats suggesting that altitude makes common antidepressants less effective. Plus, there's a lot of statistics on suicide.
There clearly are differences in suicide rates by altitude, and that's a trend that has been seen and documented over a number of years.
Emmy Betts is an emergency physician and researcher at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. She also just wrapped up a stint on the Colorado Suicide Prevention Commission.
I think it's also really important that we look at the other factors that probably have more to do with whether it's an urban or rural area, the types of people who choose to live in sometimes often remote mountain areas. So things like access to firearms, access to behavioral health care, the sort of potential stigma in the society around asking for help.
In other words, even if altitude does affect a person's suicide risk, it's only a little sliver of the picture. That said,
we certainly should be looking at how things like how antidepressants might work differently at high altitude and so forth.
And what we can do about it. Could oxygen supplementation help? Or maybe there are drugs that might counteract the effects of high altitude on the brain. Brent Caius says it's exciting. Maybe this will lead to a better understanding of how to treat lots of people with depression, not just those at elevation. And in case you're wondering, how about just leave the mountains?
Well, but there's so many other good reasons to live in the mountains. We like to point out that there's this paradox that we have high rates of depression and suicide, and we're also some of the happiest people in the country.
For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Ray Ellen Bichel.
Over 600 Indigenous students and their educators gathered at Central Wyoming College this week for the annual Native American Education Conference. Juvenile defender Nubia Pena works with youth in Utah who have been caught up in the school-to-prison pipeline. Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr sat down with her during the conference to talk about what teachers on the Wind River Reservation can do to advocate for their students.
So your keynote this morning was about the school-to-prison pipeline. Can you explain what that is?
Yes, the school-to-prison pipeline refers to the policies and practices that push our nation's school children, especially our most at risk, out of classrooms and into the juvenile and criminal justice system. It is where we have prioritized incarceration over education. So it's really different, I think, for everyone that experiences the pipeline. Some of them, it could be because of under-resourced schools. For others, it could be because there is mass surveillance of law enforcement in their communities as well as their schools. But what essentially it means is that there's a bit of a target on them because they might be unruly or they might do certain things that catches the attention of administrators or educators. And that behavior is criminalized versus normalized as just adolescent behavior. And so what happens is these children are pushed out of schools. They're given in-school suspensions, out-of-school suspensions, expulsions, and eventually referred to law enforcement. And it's very difficult once they are entered into the system, the pipeline system, for them to come back in because there's very rarely reintegration systems. So I think our educators have such a unique privilege to create and cultivate spaces where youth are empowered, where they feel like they belong. Our teachers, I was so grateful for being here with this at this conference because everyone that was here wants to work on behalf of Native youth so that we increase graduation rates, we increase college entry ways, and that we also decrease suicide and depression and substance abuse and involvement in the juvenile justice and adult criminal system.
And what are some of the strategies that you and these educators that you met today have been talking about?
Yeah, so some of the strategies that educators can implement is one, partnering with maybe some non-traditional partners. So Wyoming has some really great initiatives. The Wyoming Action Alliance is for after-school programming. And after schools from 3 to 6 is some of the most vulnerable times for our kids. That's usually when either if they're with their friends, they could possibly get in trouble, engage in some delinquent behavior. But after-school programs that are available in our Wyoming community are really robust. And I encourage people to look into that because that creates pro-social environments. It increases protective factors for kids because they're exposed to people that care about them. They're also exposed to people who know about resources that could help them if there's domestic violence in the home, if there is legal proceedings that they need to be worried about. The other strategy was bringing social justice into our classrooms, teaching our children to be civically engaged and encouraging them to be active participants in their communities towards change.
Okay, and a lot of the educators that are at this conference are Native themselves, but many more are not. And you had some questions from teachers about what do I do as a white educator if the students in my classroom have some distrust towards me?
Well, actually, the advice came from one of the participants themselves. So she mentioned that in her classroom, sometimes she gets called racist because she is white and her students are Native. And what she did instead of dismissing it or shutting it down or telling them how inappropriate that was, what she said, you know what would help is if you go to college and you get the position as an educator and then you work me out of a job. She wasn't in any way fazed by the fact that children were exploring the use of these words. She wasn't threatened by the fact that kids understand that they live in a world where there is racism. And so she, I think, gave the most beautiful response, which is allow children to practice what it is that they will experience out in the real world. Because you as an educator can harness that and create a sense of trust and safety that not everyone who is not from your community is against you.
Well, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with me.
Absolutely. It was such a pleasure. And thank you again for being here.
Savannah Marr is a Report for America Corps member. You can learn more about the project at reportforamerica.org. Mm-hmm. When we come back, we will take you to an area in the Bighorns that could get an upgrade that not everyone is in love with. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. 150 years ago, a group of explorers led by Civil War veteran John Wesley Powell set out to document the canyons of the Green and Colorado Rivers. It was the first trip of its kind. To commemorate the journey, a group of scientists have been retracing his steps this summer. Luke Runyon spoke by phone with the trip's leader during one of their stops.
When I reached University of Wyoming geography professor Tom Minkley, he was along the banks of Lake Powell in Arizona, keeping an eye on the five boats he and his colleagues are using to traverse through the canyons of the Colorado Plateau. For those people who maybe have never heard of John Wesley Powell, who was he?
So, yeah, John Wesley Powell was a Civil War hero who lost his arm in battle, and he went on to become one of the United States, great explorer heroes, actually one of the last great exploration of the lower 48 states was John Wesley Powell's trip down the Green and Colorado Rivers.
When you read Powell's journals from this trip that you're taking, there are these moments where he's just in awe of what he's seeing and then putting that down onto the page. Do you feel some of that too?
You can't do a trip like this and not be in awe of the landscapes that you're transiting to.
He uses a lot of exclamation points, I noticed when I was reading, especially when he gets to like the top of a viewpoint, lots of exclamation points to talk about what he's seeing.
It's a punctuated landscape for sure. I mean, even in today's world of, you know, tweets and everything, you would have to use a lot of exclamation points for what we've seen and experienced on this trip.
Minkley's group launched in late May from Green River, Wyoming, in the same spot and on the same day John Wesley Powell and his crew of nine men launched in 1869. And along the way, more than 60 people, including fellow scientists, environmentalists, tribal leaders, and water managers, joined Minkley's crew. So it's been 150 years since Powell did this trip. Why did you feel like it was important to commemorate it? Basically, why was his trip noteworthy in the first place?
His first trip really, it filled in the blank spaces on the map of the American West. And immediately in Powell's world, he started talking about the critical water supplies and how we could use that for the betterment of society. And it seems like that discussion persists to this day.
In the time since Powell's journey, Minkley says we've fundamentally changed how the Green and Colorado Rivers function and what they look like. Unlike Powell, Minkley's group has had to portage around large dams like Flaming Gorge in Utah and Glen Canyon Dam in Arizona. Part of Powell's legacy, he says, is that he warned lawmakers in Washington, D.C. not to overuse the river. But much of what's been built in the basin is well within Powell's vision for the West.
He saw the region as a land of scarcity, and so you wanted the strong role of government to put in infrastructure so that the people could decide what they wanted to do in the region. And so he felt that it would be all agrarian use, you know, so pasture, range lands. He couldn't have envisioned the growth of Phoenix and Los Angeles. Denver would be getting water supplies, Fort Collins. You know, the Colorado River provides water to most of the major cities in the West. He probably couldn't envision that. But he also saw that the arid region was a land of scarcity. And I think he would have, you know, at least my interpretation of his writings is that you have to plan on the scarce end, not on the abundance end. And that's where I think he might have strong opinions about our utilization now. There is a lot of needs for water in the West, and we just have to decide, are we doing the best we can with the supply that we have?
That was University of Wyoming geography professor Tom Minkley talking about recreating John Wesley Powell's historic trip down the Green and Colorado Rivers in 1869. I'm Luke Runyon.
This story is part of ongoing coverage of the Colorado River, produced in partnership with public radio station KUNC in Colorado, with financial support by the Walton Family Foundation. Summertime in Wyoming means more opportunities to enjoy the outdoors. In the Bighorn Mountains near Sheridan, trails are getting busier every year. One local organization has proposed an expansion to a trail system that gives locals more opportunities to explore the mountains. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler has more.
Redgrade Road starts a few miles southwest of the town of Bighorn and winds through the Bighorn Mountains. Right near the road is the Redgrade Trail System, which is a couple miles of scenic hiking and biking loops through the foothills. Hikers can see tall trees, small streams, and the bright wildflowers that bloomed earlier this season. Since the trails are so accessible, they've gotten busy over the past few years, and popular. A survey by the Sheridan Recreation District shows residents want more opportunities like this to get outside.
The number one outdoor need that folks in our community felt they needed were hiking and biking trails. In fact, 66% of respondents listed that as their top priority.
Chris Verba from the Sheridan Community Land Trust says his group, along with Sheridan County, proposed an expansion to the Redgrade Trail System. It includes 15 miles of non-motorized trails and 3 parking areas. Verba says it will provide more access to the mountains for residents who want it.
So that's hiking, biking, bird watching, flower looking, equestrian, of course. But ultimately, they'll have opportunities to be able to get out and experience what makes the Bighorn so special and so beautiful.
The proposed trail expansion weaves through land owned by Sheridan County, the Bureau of Land Management, and the U.S. Forest Service. The Land Trust would be responsible for funding, building, and maintaining the trails. Since the project is so large, it may take years for it to be completed. Verba says the expanded Redgrade Trail System will be a way to foster sustainable activity in the area for years to come.
It's not always easy to get up to the top of Redgrade, and this winds up being able to provide more recreational opportunities.
In May, the Forest Service approved the proposal in a draft decision and released the final environmental assessment. Sarah Evans-Curl is with the Forest Service in Sheridan.
The decision's been made. We do have the objection process we still need to go through to finalize it.
The Council for the Bighorn Range, a conservation group, filed one of 3 objections to the decision. Its president, Rob Davidson, says he thinks the Forest Service hasn't fully taken into account the impact the expansion would have on the forest.
We believe the environmental concerns were not fully recognized against the environmental impacts of this area that has not been developed before. They were underestimating the impacts because they're not just something going to have day use. They're also going to have events and community activities and stuff like that based around the area.
Davidson says the forest plan states some of the land is supposed to be managed for wildlife, not recreation. He says the wildlife is already stressed from the increased traffic on Redgrade Road over the years.
As they point out, the elk got moved by the increasing traffic on Redgrade, and the assumption is that they got moved off here further. Now this goes even into pushing them off further up into the north and to the east, and we don't think that was fully considered.
Amy Ormseth, district ranger for the Tongue Ranger District, says the wildlife management designation means wildlife takes precedent, but recreation is also an established part of that area.
That management area still has a plant and wildlife habitat emphasis. So the other things in the area, not that they can't exist there, it's just that there, when we come to make decisions in those areas, we just want to make sure that that stays as an emphasis.
The environmental assessment states the wildlife is already impacted by the increased traffic on Red Grade Road and the current recreation in the area. It adds the proposed trails are close to the main road and likely won't have any adverse effects on the wildlife in the area. The Regional Forest Service Office in Denver is now reviewing the objections and the draft decision and hopes to have a response to the Council for the Bighorn Range by September 3rd. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler in Bighorn.
The University of Wyoming has hired a new dean to oversee the Department of Agriculture. Barbara Rasko is a food scientist, an engineer, and attorney known around the world for her work on food safety. Now she's bringing that knowledge to bear on Wyoming's deep history in ranching and its new progress in local food entrepreneurship. Rasko told Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards that her experience as director of food science at the University of Washington is useful in understanding Wyoming's special agricultural challenges.
In eastern Washington particularly, we had a lot of row crops, orchards, some of the most productive wheat land on the planet. So we have some high productivity wheat land here, but we don't have a lot of it. So mostly what we have in Wyoming here is high altitude agriculture, a lot of grazing, and grazing both on private and public lands. So I think the issue that's facing us in agriculture here that makes farming here and generally maybe a little more difficult than in other places is the fact that it's an arid environment, but also the high altitude. So one of our major initiatives with the college is to focus on the needs of high altitude agriculture, both in a animal production and plant production context, and we're looking to move that initiative forward.
As I'm sure you know, we are really working on, in the state of Wyoming, on diversifying our economy. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how agriculture might be able to play a role in helping to do that.
I think there's many opportunities in agriculture. We have a lot of producers who have already diversified what they do on their ranches as far as getting into tourism-type activities, recreational activities, and expanding the scope of their businesses to attract people to small communities in Wyoming where they can actually get an experience of being on a working ranch. That's, to me, is very exciting. I think, though, too, there's opportunities for crop diversification on a small scale where people could then build out a small business with the ability to reach metropolitan areas in the western United States with specialty products. We've had a lot of opportunities regionally in microbrewing, baking new types of legumes and ancient grains. And I think there's a number of opportunities we could take some advantage of here. I know we've got some of our beef and lamb producers that are working on some very interesting initiatives to try to put production capacity in the state and also to develop new markets for their meat, both domestically and internationally.
One of the challenges, too, that I know for a lot of ranchers has been they're having to do a lot of shipping their meat out to USDA processors. The meats get sort of swept into the bulk meat supply,
right,
and we lose that Wyoming grown label.
That's right.
And so how can the university kind of help with that?
We do have some regional co-op producers now that have slaughter facilities. So I think there's going to be some opportunities there. There are a couple fairly small operations within the state that are starting, they're starting up. And I think they're going to provide the opportunity for our meat producers to get into a niche market, at least to some extent. At the university, we do have a meat science program, and we have a very nice meat lab, and we have students that are learning how to make different types of products, so different types of cuts, but also sausages, jerkies, dried products that are popular snack items now. And I think if we can expand that and help our local producers maybe do some product development and some consumer testing, those would be opportunities I think that would be good to explore as part of our meat science program and our animal science department.
One of those crops, it sounds like, that we might be able to start to grow is hemp.
Right.
As that's happening nationwide, but also the state of Wyoming is putting together their plan as well. What role will the university be able to play in that as that rolls out?
I think what we can do is we have experts in a wide range of plant crops and also in plant protection. So I see our role as being able to support growers to answer some of the technical questions they might have with just the growth of hemp in the Wyoming environment, which is going to be arid and at a higher altitude, possibly with selection of certain varieties that might be more suitable for this environment, and dealing with the issues of soil water utilization and pest management that all growers face. So it'll be a new crop for us, just like it is for everybody else. But within our faculty, we have people that would have expertise that should be able to address or help address grower questions.
The next generation is having a tendency to move out of the state and not necessarily come back to take up those ranches and make sure that they get passed along generation to generation. What can we do to kind of start to help some of those ranchers, support them as this generational challenge kind of continues?
One of the things I think is important, we have a number of students who are interested in working in a ranch environment as in professional capacities, one sort or another. I'd like to see maybe more integration with our ranchers and our students who are coming out who are not from a ranch family that would like to be able to have professional opportunities in that area. So I think that's something that we're going to be working on here, both in terms of internships, but also with some degree programs that are going to support having young people be able to have the technical and business skills that they need to be successful in that area.
Another challenge for a lot of, ag producers in the state is an increase in droughts, wildfires, floods. What are we going to be kind of doing from the university standpoint to kind of help those ranchers, support them going forward?
What we do have people that are studying areas of fire and the impact of fire, also wildlife, domestic animal interactions, a very strong veterinary science diagnostic lab to help to ensure that diseases aren't spreading through our livestock, and how to help producers control any type of disease that might come about. We're working on invasive plant species initiatives. There's lots of issues whenever fire comes through an area of what type of forage crops come back in that area and what the quality of that forage might be and what you can graze on it and how to manage grazing opportunities. So we have people working in an interdisciplinary manner trying to understand some of these issues that we're facing because of either climate shifts or climate change. We do have faculty who are in interdisciplinary teams with others across our college, but also across the university to try to work on strategies to address some of these new issues that are facing our producers.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up on the program, we will learn about the importance of music for some of the internees of Heart Mountain. And we will hear about a number of strong women in Jackson. This is Open Spaces. You are listening to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. The Heart Mountain Interpretive Center focuses on remembering the injustices Japanese Americans faced during World War II. But the current special exhibition at Heart Mountain wants to remember how some of the nearly 11,000 incarcerees tried to find normal lives through music at the camp. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska reports. The Songs on the Wind exhibit tells the story of music at Heart Mountain.
Memories like the corners of my mind.
That's the voice of Joy Takeshita Teraoka singing in a film by Julian Saporiti for the exhibit. Teraoka was a singer in the George Egawa Orchestra, a band of Japanese-American incarcerees at Heart Mountain during World War II.
That's the thing about the Japanese in those relocation camps. They didn't sit around and mope as a whole. They got up and made something more positive, as positive as it could be.
Teraoka was just 15 when Japanese Americans were evacuated from their homes in 1942 to internment camps. When she arrived at Heart Mountain, she decided she would audition to be a singer for the orchestra, and she got the part.
Oh, it's a thrill and an honor, because if we were back home in Los Angeles, I know the opportunity would never have come to me.
Teraoka took joy out of her experience of performing music at Heart Mountain. But this was something that co-curator Julian Saporiti struggled with. How could such a horrific experience lead to something positive?
The fact that she got up on stage and sang, to me, is a pretty incredible thing. Once you zoom out from that song and you go outside that mess hall, and you know how cold it is in Wyoming, or how dusty it is during the summer, and then you keep zooming out past the barbed wire, and you keep zooming out past the guards.
The efforts of trying to lead a normal life while being imprisoned is what the exhibit hopes to portray.
What was it like to be 15, 16 years old and just have that reprieve from the Wyoming winter and the barbed wire and the searchlights and go dancing in a barrack or a mess hall?
As Saporiti and his co-curator Aaron Aoyama did more research, Aoyama says they found out that the bands which formed at Heart Mountain didn't only perform in the camp.
Even though these Japanese Americans were incarcerated, weren't able to really, you know, leave camp or live freely, they did leave to go play at a prom in Thermopolis, a Mormon dance in Lovell.
It turns out they played all over Northwest Wyoming. Aoyama says even though it was wartime, Wyomingites still wanted live music and wanted to dance.
This band was also kind of goodwill ambassadors, sort of reintroducing or introducing for the first time Japanese American faces to some of these places.
She says, according to clips in newspapers, people really enjoyed the band. They even got standing ovations. The band played popular music of the time, like Glenn Miller and Tommy Dorsey. But they also played traditional Japanese music.
The origins of the band rest with this man named George Egawa, who before the war was a tenor saxophone player in Los Angeles.
When Egawa was rounded up and taken to camp, he, like every other Japanese American, could only bring what they could carry. Egawa brought his trombone. And then he went looking for others who made the same choice as him.
Chose to bring an instrument. So chose to bring a trombone case or a guitar or a violin or a saxophone. And so he found these guys and formed a band.
These musicians were trying to make the best of a desperate situation. So to Julian Saporiti, the most natural way to tell this story was through a song.
And I think also for Joy and these musicians who I'm trying to tell a story of was to write this song, which is just verbatim what I'd been told or what I'd dug through camp newspapers. And it can reach a heck of a lot more people.
Under starlight, they dance behind barbed wire. Under the mountain, it meant something to sing. Stuck between two countries in a fire, the best band in Wyoming.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadelska at the Center of the West in Cody.
Wyoming is the Equality State, and when StoryCorps came to Jackson in 2018, Andrew Breffel told StoryCorps facilitator Madison Mullen about the legacy of strong women in Jackson and why, in his opinion, they deserve to be remembered.
Helen Lang was the first nurse in Jackson Hole in 1920. She worked for Dr. Huff. Helen was a girl who was born to royalty in Russia.
Can you tell me a bit more about them?
They were summarily expelled from Russia by the Revolution of 1905, and she moved out of an enormous mansion with thousands of servants and thrown into utter poverty in the United States through Ellis Island and no money, and they built a grass sod hut. But like Americans from all over the world, they managed and ultimately prospered. She ended up going to a nursing school in Hot Springs, South Dakota, and learned to become a nurse. She eventually moved on from being Dr. Huff's nurse to becoming the first social services director for Jackson Hole for many, many years. And although she was a little fireplug of a lady under 5 feet tall, the story was that no panhandler ever lasted on the town square in Jackson Hole for more than 24 hours before Helen Lang grabbed him by the lapels and sent him on his way. At one point, I came into possession of a paper she had written when she was the head of the social services about spinster ladies, hermits, living in Jackson Hole by themselves. And a lot of them lived down on the Elk Refuge. And she was one of the only women keeping track of these hermit women who would come to town maybe every 6 months or a year to get salt and whatever other essentials they might need, and I guess otherwise lived off the game.
So what does that mean to be a spinster hermit woman, in her words?
Oh, they were pioneers. They were women that lived alone and had nobody to care for them, and made a hard scrabble life of their own out in the wilds, and needed no men and asked for none and seldom ever asked for help. And it's a culture that utterly disappeared without notice. I just wanted to give acknowledgement to it because I think Jackson Hole has a long, rich history of strong women, and I think some of them utterly unregarded.
And why is it important to you? Why do you think these women had such an impact on you enough to want to talk about them?
Because I don't want them to be forgotten.
That's Andrew Breffel speaking with Madison Mullen at StoryCorps in Jackson. Megan Feary produced this piece. To find other StoryCorps episodes, you can go to our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Thanks for listening to this edition of Open Spaces. If you missed part of the show or want to hear it or an individual segment again, You can find it on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. All you have to do is click on Open Spaces. Anna Rader takes care of all of this as our web editor. You can also get our podcast from the usual locations or find our stories on our Facebook page. We also encourage good ideas for future shows, so if you have an interview or a segment you'd like us to do, just send us an email. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.